The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
I want to dedicate this week's shiur, this week's class on the portion of Mishpatim and the issue of freedom in memory of Avram Chaim Ben Leib, Albert Fingerman, who I had the privilege of meeting a number of times a long time ago and know him more through his son. This class should be in the Ilui Neshama. It should be an elevation of his soul. I can honestly say that this is the first time that we have ever done a class with people who are sitting Shiva, and it should be a comfort. And it raises actually a very interesting question. You know, this week's portion contains a very wide variety of different topics. Like, technically speaking, Mishpatim is the portion that follows Yitro. It's the portion that follows immediately after, sort of Mount Sinai and the Revelation and the Ten Commandments. And it's interesting that when you get to the portion of Mishpatim, you really get down to the brass tacks. This is the portion at which we begin to explore the laws themselves. And you can really divide this portion into a number of different topics, some of which are very obvious and some of which are very strange. The portion begins with a discussion about the whole topic of slavery, right? Eile ha-mishpatim asher tasim lifneihem. These are the laws, the statutes that you should place before them. It's interesting that the Kutzko Rebbe suggests that's not a random choice of words. Because the whole point of Jewish tradition is that it has to be placed lifneihem. It has to be before them. You know, if the laws, you know, I remember when I was teaching high school kids and they would take furious notes. You know, you never really spoke to people's faces. You more often spoke to the tops of their heads because they were busy looking down writing notes. Then you would ask them the question sort of on the class a week later and they wouldn't remember, but they'd know that it was in their notebooks, you know? And sometimes these laws, they sit in books, they sit on library shelves, they sit in teachers' minds. If they're not lifneihem, if Judaism and Jewish tradition isn't laid out before a person on a table, if it's not something that he's invited to partake from or she's invited to enjoy, then something's missing. And it's interesting that sets the stage for all of the topics in this week's portion. Tzedek, tzedek, tirdof, you should pursue justice. Midvar sheker tirchak, you should distance yourself from falsehood, right? And on, which is what makes the beginning of this portion so strange, right? Ki tikne eved ivri, if you will purchase, okay, a Hebrew slave, that's the literal translation. Sheishanim yavod, he's going to work for 6 years. Uvashvit yatzei lechofshi chinam. And he gets to go free in the 7th year. So, on the one hand, you know, relative to, I suppose, slavery pre-Civil War, never mind, you know, Jews slaving in the gulags, I guess the fact that a slave got to go free every 7 years was probably relative to the way society worked 3,000 years ago, not a small feat. On the other hand, from our perspective today, the fact that you could buy a human being, the fact that you could purchase a slave, that a person could be enslaved to you, that seems so anathema to what Judaism is all about, especially when you begin to get into the details of this week's portion, which are so much about sensitivity and human beings' place in society. You know, ki yireh hamor soncha, if you see the donkey of your worst enemy, put aside for the moment how you could have a worst enemy, and should you have a worst enemy, especially given that the Torah tells us here, lo tisnat achicha bilvavecha, you're not supposed to hate your brother in your heart. You know, it's interesting, Maimonides, in the Guide to the Perplexed, asks the question, what is the most difficult mitzvah in the Torah? What's the most difficult mitzvah in the Torah? So some people might think it's Shabbat. I don't personally find Shabbat difficult. I don't understand how anyone would fall in love with Shabbat, right? You know, Friday afternoon, you put away your laptop, you put away your cell phone, you put away your BlackBerry, you sit with your family around the Shabbat table, you get to eat. Who wouldn't want that? Some people might think the most difficult is Kashrut, but I guess they've never been to Israel, because around here, kosher food, not a difficult mitzvah. So what's the most difficult mitzvah? The Rambam says the most difficult mitzvah is not to hate your fellow human being in your heart. In other words, Judaism believes that you're capable not only of controlling and developing how you behave, but you're even expected to rise above what you could think. You can decide that a person who you might have every reason not to be able to stand, you can make a decision to love that human being. That's an easy thing to say. It's a very hard thing to do. So how can it be that in this portion that contains such a noble precept, that it begins with the concept of servitude, that we can take a human being and enslave him? Im begapoyavo, begapoyetze, whatever he comes with, that's what he goes out with, right? Whatever he earns, builds, makes, marries, sort of in the context of slavery, he doesn't get to take with him, it belongs to his master. Im baalishahu, if he's a husband, viatza ishto imo, then his wife goes out with him. But if he marries her when he's an indentured slave, it's not so easy. Im adonav yiten lo isha, v'yaldalo vanim uvanot, etc., etc., etc. So this is a very, very, very difficult section. And without getting to the details of slavery, just to sort of paint the picture of exactly what is going on here, the ima mor yomar ha'eved, and if the slave will say, ahavti et adoni, I love my master, et tishti et banai, I love my wife and children, who were, I guess, also indentured servants, or Canaanite slaves, and I got to sort of build a family here, I don't want to leave them, lo etze chofshi, I'm not going to go free. So then you do this strange thing, you take him to court, and you take him to the door, to the mezuzah, and you pierce his ear. This is the first official sanctioning of earrings, right? You pierce his ear. Well, what is that all about? So it's interesting to note that Judaism has a very different perception of what this means. First of all, the word slavery is very misleading. For example, the Talmud says that if you have an Eved Ivri, an indentured servant, we'll call him now, in your house, and you only have one pillow in the house, you have to give it to him. If you only have food enough for one meal for one person, he gets to eat, you have to go hungry. If there's only one bed, he sleeps on the bed, you have to sleep on the floor. The fact that the indentured servant could say, I love my life and I want to stay, I guess provides an inkling of an idea that there's more to this than meets the eye. One can't imagine somebody in Buchenwald being released and saying, no, actually, I'd rather stay. So there's obviously something going on here. And it's important to understand this idea in order to set the theme for what this portion is about. So it's interesting. How did this work? How did a person become an indentured servant? Right? So imagine for a moment that someone's down on his luck. I don't know. He has a passion he can't control, or he can't support his family, and he sort of takes the direction that Judaism doesn't prescribe, and he steals. Okay? Guy steals $100,000. And he spends it. And maybe, by the way, he spends it on good things, and maybe he doesn't spend it on good things, and then he gets caught. Right? What do you do with such a person? You've just caught a fellow who's embezzled, or he's stolen. What do you do with him? So, in our society, it's very simple. You throw him into jail. It's interesting that in Judaism, one does not find the concept of jail as a consequence of one's actions. In fact, the only place that you find jail time in Judaism, in the Torah, is when they have no idea what to do. Right? They have a guy chopping wood on Shabbat and they're not sure what to do with him. They lock him up. There are two elders prophesying in the camp. It's not clear whether they've broken some precept. Yeshua comes to Moshe. Adoni Moshe Klaim. Lock them up. Locking them up essentially seems to imply we have no idea what to do with them. It's not a solution. It's a part of the problem. Which is interesting when you think about it, because if you look at today's society, I don't think there are many people left who really believe that incarceration is part of the solution. We're not rehabilitating the 3 to 4 million individuals who are sitting in our prisons in America. Right? So, what do you do? What do you do if someone's stolen money? Right? And you catch him. Well, so in Judaism, the first thing he has to do, he has to give it back. That would seem to be pretty obvious. But what do you do if he doesn't have it to give back? If he doesn't have it to give back, then you actually value what this person's servitude would be worth. And he has to serve for the amount of time it would take to the equivalent of the funds that he's stolen. In other words, if a year's worth of his work is $25,000, then he has to sell himself as an indentured servant for 4 years. Now think about this for a moment, because this is an incredible idea. You see, such a person reaches a stage in their life where they feel they have nothing left. They've made a huge mistake. They have nothing. And they probably feel that they're worthless. I have nothing to offer. I have nothing to give. Judaism comes to such a person and says, I will teach you that you have value. I will teach you within the context of society that you are worthwhile, that you have what to offer. That's an incredible idea. So the theme of the portion of Mishpatim begins with the concept that every human being has value. And it's within the context of the fact that every human being has value that we can begin to explore the nature of the portion. Which brings us to a very interesting, I guess you could call it an event, that occurs at the end of this week's portion. Okay? If you look in the portion of Mishpatim, right? Hang on a second, let me find it here. If you look in chapter 24, Perek Chaf Dalet, it says, Ve'el Moshe Amar, so God says to Moshe, Alei El Hashem, you should come up to Hashem, Atah Ve'aron Nadav Ve'avihu Ve'shivim V'ziknei Yisrael. Right? It's interesting that when Moshe goes up to Mount Sinai, the portions of Yitro and Mishpatim get a little confusing. When did Sinai happen? When did it end? Moshe is told to go up and come down and go up. So it would seem that this is sort of not quite chronological sequence, because Moshe is going up on Mount Sinai here. Interesting also, by the way, is that after Moshe goes up, no less than Nadav and Avihu follow Aaron up. Now, Nadav and Avihu are the two sons of Aaron who were killed in the book of Leviticus in the portion of Shemini, right? Because they offered some sort of a strange fire. We'll get into that in a few weeks. And it's in this verse that you actually begin to realize what we lost when we lost Nadav and Avihu, the sons of Aaron. These were the future leaders of the Jewish people. They were so great that they went up on Mount Sinai ahead of the elders, ahead of the Sanhedrin. So Moshe goes up alone, and Vayavo Moshe Vayisaper, and he speaks over the words of God. Vayichtov Moshe et kol divrei Hashem, and he writes down all the words of God. And then Vayashkem baboker, he arises early in the morning. Now the language of Vayashkem is always a language of mission. Vayashkem Avram baboker Vayachavosh et chamoro. Avraham arises early to saddle his donkey, to take his son to the Akedah, to the binding of Isaac. Moshe saddles his donkey to go down to Egypt to redeem the Jewish people. Every time you see this language, this word, Vayashkem, there's a moment of mission. So this is an important moment. Moshe arises early, Vayiven Mizbeach, and he builds an altar, Tachat Ha'ar, beneath the mountain. Ushtemesle Matseva, and he places apparently 12, it would seem, stones as a monument, L'shnemasar Shiftei Yisrael, to the 12 tribes of Israel. Very strange, strange verse. Vayishlach et narei b'nei Yisrael, and he sends the lads, the boys of Israel, and they offer up sacrifices, vayalu alot, vayizbechu zvachim, vayikach Moshe, and then he takes blood, and he sprinkles it, they're creating an altar. Vayikach sefer abrit, and he takes the book of the covenant, which would seem to be the Torah that he's just been given, vayikra bozneam, and he reads it to the people. What is this? And then, one of the most famous lines in the Torah, after Moshe builds this altar, or this monument, or a combination of both, placing 12 stones as some sort of a monument, and sprinkling blood on the altar, then he reads the Torah in the ears of the people, Vayomru kol asher diber Hashem nasev nishma. And they say, everything that God has said, we will do and we will listen. So there are two interesting questions here. The first is, what is this monument? You know, when the Jewish people cross over into the land of Israel, so 12 men take 12 stones and they place them in the Jordan River and they make another monument in Gilgal when they've crossed into the land of Israel, that I understand. What is this doing here in the middle of the desert at Mount Sinai? And why does it appear here? It's interesting, there's a debate between two of the commentaries on the Torah, Rashi and the Ramban. Rashi, Rav Shlomo Yitzchaki, who lived from 1040 to 1105, probably the medieval commentator, he suggests that this actually occurred before Sinai, that it's a monument to the Jewish people's willingness to receive the Torah. Of course, that's very difficult, because what is it doing here? if it's at, you know, sort of before Sinai, when we've now finished the portion of Sinai. The Ramban, on the other hand, Nachmanides, right, Rav Moshe ben Nachman, who lived in the 13th century, who actually came to Israel in the year 1267 after his famous debate with Pablo Christiani, the Ramban, who was a big believer that unless you're absolutely pressed, you should always assume that the chronological order remains true, the Ramban says, no, this happened after Sinai. But even according to the Ramban, if this happened immediately after Sinai, it should have been at the end of last week's portion. Why does it occur at the end of this week's portion? Either way, this monument has to somehow occur after the Jewish people have begun to struggle with, to embrace, to ensconce the actual mitzvot, the actual recipe for becoming a better human being in this world. Right? Which, of course, brings us to the second question, which is the whole verse of Na'aseh v'nishma. There's something very difficult about the concept of Na'aseh v'nishma, right? What the Jewish people basically are saying, right? Na'aseh, we will do, v'nishma, and we will listen. Now, by the way, this phrase is so significant that it's become the epitome of what receiving Torah is all about. As a matter of fact, the Talmud in Tractate Shabbat, don't quote me on this, but I think it's on folio 89, Daf Petet, right? Says, Mi gila lebanai razeh, who revealed to my children this great secret? 600,000 angels come down from heaven, placing crowns on the heads of the Jewish people, which need not necessarily be taken literally, but certainly allegorically. There's something very powerful about this line. And what's difficult about that, at you know, first glance, you would say, well, this is a wonderful thing. The Jewish people are willing to accept the Torah sight unseen. Everybody knows the famous Midrash, the rabbinic legend. God goes to all the nations of the world. God says to the, you know, the nations, why don't you accept my Torah? So he comes to the Ishmaelites, and he says to the Ishmaelites, why don't you accept my Torah? So they say, what's in it? Right? So he says, don't steal. So they say, well, thank you very much. How are we going to earn a living? Forget it. Right? He comes to the Edomites, which in rabbinic tradition are sort of the forebearers, the forerunners of Rome, Edom, right? So it comes to the Edomites, the sons of Esav, and they say, what does it say in it? And he says, don't kill. So they say, what do you want from us? That's what we do. He comes to the Jews, and the Jews say, Naaseh, let us do it. It's a little bit of a stacked deck, right? I mean, God could have said, you know, it says every seventh day you get to take the day off. He could have said, you're going to have cholent every Shabbos morning. He doesn't do that. But okay, putting that aside, on the one hand, it's a beautiful idea. On the other hand, there's something very problematic about this. Because what the Jewish people are basically doing is they're abrogating their intellectual capacity to explore what the Torah is all about. In fact, Rabbeinu Yonah, one of the medieval commentators, asked this question on Ethics of the Fathers on Pirkei Avot. In Pirkei Avot, it suggests in Ethics of the Fathers, Lo ha-limud ha-ikar ela ma'aseh. Learning is not the main thing. Action is the main thing. Right? It's not about how much you learn Torah, it's about what you choose to do with it. If you learn all the Torah in the world, but it doesn't change who you are, there's no point to it. Right? So Rabbeinu Yonah says, wait a second, it's all very well and nice to say that the learning isn't the main thing, that the doing is the main thing, but if you learn, if you don't learn about it, how can you do it? Right? You're reading the Torah, Ukshatam le'ot al yadecha. You're going to tie these adornments on your hands. If you don't have some explanation, if you don't study it, and you wake up the next morning and say, okay, I'm ready to do this, how could you do it? You don't know what they are. You don't know what color they are. You don't know how to strap them. You don't know what they mean. It's not at all clear. As a matter of fact, if you did it only according to what the Torah that was given, you'd be tying boxes on your hands instead of on your forearms. Right? So how can this be? And I want you to understand, this is a very difficult question. You know, I remember when I was in the Army. So when I was in officer's course, at a certain point they decided that it was too expensive to bus us all the way down to deep in the desert, right? Because you would lose basically a whole day getting the guys all the way down there. And a day of officer's course was a very expensive affair. It cost like, I don't know, 100,000 shekel to maintain the base per cadet per day. So they decided that it was smarter to fly us down. So, you know, the first week it was very cool because, you know, I told all my friends I'm flying down to base. But after once or twice, it was really depressing. Because until then, you had gotten on a bus, and then another bus, and, you know, you had this whole day to decompress, and, you know, would take a good book and get some garinim fistukim, you know, like nuts and just nosh all the way down, and you would have a chance to sort of get back into the zone of being in the Army. But now, you would show up at the airport, right, at 9:30, and it wasn't like Ben-Gurion, you know, there's no duty-free. This was the no-frills part of the airport, you know? You sat on the floor, and there was a security guy there who came and checked your papers, and that was it, right? And you would get on the plane at 10 o'clock exactly, and there were no, like, nice-looking, you know, flight attendants. There was a guy, scruffy, and he would go back, and he would make sure that you had your seatbelt on, and if you didn't have it, he'd slap you on the head, right? And then you'd take off, right? No movies. 30 minutes later, you landed near the base. By 11 o'clock, 11:15, you were already working on the tanks. It was incredibly depressing. But the most fascinating part of that whole experience was that I remember that every Sunday morning, without fail, now mind you, this was a high-security area, right? This was the military terminal in Ben-Gurion Airport. And you needed security clearance to get in there. Like, they didn't fly regular soldiers in this terminal. You had to be an officer cadet. And yet, every Sunday morning, without fail, there were two Lubavitchers, two Chabad guys who were there with their tefillin. Right? They were tefillinizing the guys. Right? And I remember thinking it was such a strange thing. They would go around, didn't want to put tefillin on. And you know, there'd always be like one guy. He was in the middle of, you know, talking about his Saturday night activities, and we're not talking about what tractate of Talmud he learned. It was more about Rachel or Leah or something like that. And he would interrupt, and what the heck, you know, as a lark, he would put tefillin on, sort of winking out of one eye. And I remember thinking, like, if I had an hour with a group of cadets, most of whom had never seen a kippah on their heads, is that the best way to use the hour, to put a piece of tefillin on a guy's arm? I mean, did it change him? Wouldn't it be better to sort of sit and explore it and understand it and study it? Talk about, you know, not whether you can prove God exists, but how do you develop a relationship with God? What is God? Is God relevant in my life? And yet at the end of the day, a person puts on tefillin, he's fulfilled the mitzvah. A person has a deep discussion about God, I don't know if he's fulfilled the mitzvah. So how do you find this balance between naseh and nishma? How could it be that the Jewish people accept the Torah? There's a holy dog out there who wants to learn Torah. It's okay, right? How could it be, okay, that the Jewish people completely pass up the opportunity to explore what the Torah is all about? By the way, go a stage further. Imagine that you're doing a business deal, okay? I don't know, we just hired a fellow who is very promising. He's going to be the administrative director of our new yeshiva program that we're starting in September. He's an amazing guy. And we sat for a couple of months and we looked into him and we did due diligence on him and we checked up on him and he checked up on us. And then we sat there and we wrote up a contract. The Chafetz Chaim is very specific, one of the great rabbis of the last generation. Any transaction that has to do with money or possessions, you should always have a contract. It prevents, you know, debate later on. Imagine if we wrote up a contract and this guy walked in and he took a look at it and he said, you know what, I don't need to look at this. I trust you guys, and just signed it. So I'd be very nervous about the hire. Right? You're going into a business venture. You find a guy. You think he's a great partner. The lawyer's working it for 6 months. They come up with a 200-page contract. He shows up the day, you know, sort of the contract is ready. He says, you know what, I don't need to read this. If you guys say it's good, let's just sign. So you'd be very nervous about going into business with such a partner. So Rav Avigdor Nevensal, I think, opens the door on this topic. In his Sichot L'Sefer Shmot, Rav Avigdor Nevensal, by the way, is the Rav of the Old City of Jerusalem. He's one of those rarest of individuals that you can sense him walking by. Just an amazing human being. And the stories about him are legend. And he says, I think, sort of, the truth, the essence of what this idea is all about. If some business partner that you've never met sits down with a contract and you sign it without thinking twice, then that makes you a fool. But on the other hand, it all depends on who's giving you the contract. If your dad was to give you the contract, then you'd be a fool to go through it. Because obviously, if your dad takes 6 months to write up a contract, then it could only be good for you. The only reason to read it is if he wants you to read it, right? So the Jewish people say, this is up to you. We don't need this. And what that means is that the essence of taking ownership of Judaism is recognizing where it all comes from. You know, it's interesting. People today have such a difficult perception of God. You know, Rav Kook has an amazing article. Emunah shehi kfira, kfira shehi emunah. Faith which is denial, and denial which is faith. Somebody once asked him, how could it be that everything in the world is holy, that everything came into the world to do good? What good can there be in atheism? So Rav Kook says, you know, the atheist comes to the world to bring a very important message. Because what the atheist basically says to the world is, if this is the God that you would have me believe in, I'm not interested, because God has to be better than that. And the truth is that the atheist is right. God is better than that. In fact, the God that the atheist doesn't believe in, I don't believe in either. I just think God is better than that. And that's our challenge. People have such a difficult perception of what and who God is. You know? And before you can even begin to explore a relationship with Judaism, you first have to change the nature of our relationship with God. It's interesting, I realized this with my kids. You know, kids in Israel, unfortunately, they mature very quickly. They are introduced to topics that are very difficult from a very early age. One of which, as an example, is death. You know? My children were dealing with death when they were very young. I remember in the year 2000, when the Second Intifada broke out, and I got stuck in the army for about, I don't know, 6 weeks. And we must have gotten into a gun battle every other day. And I remember one day I came home and I threw my gear in the corner. And my son, Yonatan, who must have been about 8 at the time, found my flak vest and found a bullet hole in the side of the flak vest. I have, by the way, no idea whether that bullet hole was from one of those gun battles or it was just an old vest. But it freaked him out. And we got into a whole discussion. I remember I was lying with him on his bed. Sort of one night I managed to get home from patrol. And he wouldn't let go of me. You know, he wouldn't let go of me. And he finally looks at me and says, Abba taftiach li shelo tamut. Promise me you won't die. So how do you answer that? So we got into this whole discussion. Well, what do you think death is? You know, very difficult. And not so long ago, unfortunately, there was a terrible event. Somebody was killed in a car accident. And I had a discussion with him again. And this time he's 14 years old. And it's a whole different discussion. And we're elevating. But most people, they have that discussion about what is God when they're 5 years old or 8 years old. And then they don't revisit the topic. So most people are walking around with a first grade perception of God. You know, it's almost as though first you have to accept that the source of all of this created you and that the source of all of this loves you. And if you really believe that Hashem created us and you believe that Hashem loves us and you believe that every human being is created in the image of God, then you're really ready to change the way you look at all of the mitzvot. Because then it's no longer a commandment. It's an opportunity. In fact, the word mitzvah, which comes from tzavta, togetherness, is an opportunity to come together with myself, to come together with my society, to come together with the world around me. And it may well be that that is the matziva, the monument that Moshe creates sort of in the midst of this exploration of the precepts of the Torah. Because within the context of accepting what's given to us from Sinai, we have to recognize that it comes from our ability to view each other as being given from Sinai, no less than the commandments. And if we can sort of create that unity of stones in a monument, then we're ready to take the Torah and do with it as it was meant to be done, to make the world a better place. So that's a little bit of forethought. I want you to know that, you know, since this is in memory of Mr. Fingerman, who just passed away, his funeral, I think, was Friday, if I'm not mistaken. And Rav Kook has an amazing article. It's called Chizayon HaMavet, The Illusion of Death. You know, most people think that death is a terrible tragedy, that it's an ending. And it's interesting that in Judaism, we have a concept of Tumat Mita, that when you come into contact with death, you become Tameh, you become unclean. Something goes wrong. So Rav Kook says, what goes wrong when you come into contact with death? Death is the great lie. And when you come into contact with death, you assume that something has ended. But Judaism believes that nothing has ended. In fact, it's quite the opposite. Something has begun. You know, you bury someone that you love. And people will say, I just buried my brother, I just buried my father. It's not true. You didn't bury your father. You buried your father's body. But that's not who your father was. In fact, your father never reaches a was, because your father will always remain an is. It's just that that is no longer in the physical world. That is somewhere else. That is moving. It's not even a somewhere. It's just different. And the idea within Kabbalah, within Jewish teachings, Hasidut, that on a person's yahrzeit, on the anniversary of a person's death, that that's really the day that a person is reborn, explains why Judaism has such a powerful series of traditions around the yahrzeit, around the anniversary of a person's passing. Because all that you're remembering is that that's the day that the person left this physical world. But that doesn't mean that that person left. Now our struggle is to try to maintain a relationship with someone who is no longer physical. So Hashem should bless us that we succeed in connecting to these mitzvot, that they become vehicles for togetherness, for unity, for discovering oneness in the world around us and inside of us. And Yiratzon Bezrat Hashem, that Mr. Fingerman should be a Melitz Yosher, that he should be, you know, an advocate for the Jewish people. We certainly need it. Rabbi Avram Chaim Ben Leib, and we wish you comfort. Makom yinachem etchem b'toch shar of Leitz Yod Yerushalayim v'lo tosifu l'davah od. Hashem should comfort you among the mourners of Zion. It's interesting that when you comfort a mourner, even if it's a single mourner, you still say Hamakom yinachem etchem, right? That the makom, that God should comfort all of you. So it's very strange. You would think that if it's just one mourner, you say Hamakom yinachem otcha. It's not true. Because in Judaism, a person never mourns alone. Why does a person never mourn alone? Because kaviyachol, it's as though God's self comes to be with the mourner. And that's why God is described in mourning as a makom. The place, the fact that we're in space with Hashem is actually what comforts us. So Yiratzon, you should be comforted, and hope Bezrat Hashem one day soon all of us will get to learn together in Yerushalayim, up on Israelites' roof, overlooking the Mount of Olives, and we'll get to watch, you know, some rebuilding while we get to reconnect with all the people who have been missing for a while. All right, I wish you all a wonderful week, and thank you all for calling in. If anybody has any questions, you know how to email me. It's binny@israelite.org. You can definitely send me an email question, and I'll try to get back to you. And I wish you all well, and Shavua Tov. Have a great week.
This presentation by Rabbi Binny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.